Hello and welcome, everyone. Thanks for joining us for our March Destiny Unveiled Community Conversation. It's nice to be back with you. My name is Viviana Sinclair. I'm here with Elijah. And our conversation this month falls between the anniversary of Rudolf Steiner's birthday, which was last week, and the anniversary of his death day, which occurs toward the end of this month on March 30th. So tonight we're going to explore various themes around the mysteries of life, death, and the seven-year soul cycles that each of us experience as a process of emergence through the course of our lives. It's just like almost like a caterpillar molting its skin and opening up to a new possibility and a whole new way of being. And what I find fascinating about it is that from the perspective of biography work, it's already lies in potential within it. But as Rudolf Steiner said, after 28, it takes our conscious participation to really move these soul cycles forward. We have to consciously begin to take hold of them ourselves. So the more awareness we can bring to them, the better. And since this work proceeded out of Steiner's work, we're going to look at his biography in relationship to the biography work so that we can get a living example of it. And also we have a biography life chart that I sent out in an email to everyone before the call began tonight, or if you're listening in later and you had access to the email, you can print that. If you can print that and have it in front of you, if you haven't done so already, while we're engaging with this call, I think it'll be very helpful as a tool just to bring, you know, you can take some notes on it and bring more consciousness to what we're going to be sharing tonight. So Elijah is here, and he is a masterful biographer, both of individual biography and humanities biography, and he's especially well-versed in Rudolf Steiner's biography through not only his last incarnation, but he's pieced together so much of a living tapestry from previous incarnations. And Elijah, I'd love for you to say hello and maybe get us started with a verse for the night.
Yeah, hello everyone. I'll start with the verse. It's from the Calendar of the Soul by Rudolf Steiner, and it's for week 48. Let certainty of thought appear in light that wills from heights of worlds and streams with strength into my soul, resolving raveled riddles of the soul as the force of its rays awakens love in human hearts. So it was interesting, Viviana, that you mentioned or alluded to the process of the caterpillar. Of course, it's the butterfly that often lays the egg. Of course, giant silk moths do the same thing, but the butterfly lays the egg, then out comes the caterpillar, and it goes through its different molting stages. So it's a great example of what we do within our own human life. And we could really say that biography work lay unconcealed until Rudolf Steiner started to share different points about what that could really look like if it was taken up in an earnest way, you know, from what he shared, especially in the Karmic Relationship series. And he himself lived an archetype of biography work in regards to the framework that's set up, where if you study each seven-year cycle, 1 to 7, 7 to 14, 14 to 21, all the way to 63, each one of these seven-year cycles stands in front of, so to speak, a leitmotif, and it's also, it stands under the influence, which I find really, really fascinating, of a planetary gesture. So the first 7 years, you have this relationship where everything is wanting to be imitated, and it falls under the influence or the signature of the moon. And then 7 to 14, Mercury. And, of course, the first 7 years, really the first 21 years, you're building up the physical body. But the first 7 years is under that rulership, so to speak, of the moon, and then Mercury comes in from 7 to 14. And the young child breaks its second teeth, the teeth come in, and it's a harbinger of the intellectual forces now that start to come in. And then 14 to 21, you have the astral body born, and that falls under the Venus cycle. So within that, you have the sweet 16 year, because 16 is not only the Venus year, it's also within the Venus cycle. So it's the Venus year within the Venus cycle. And then you've got 21 to 42, which is a three-part soul stage. So it's ruled by the sun. And I had an interesting conversation years ago. Wow, I think it was the summer of 1977. And the conversation was with Leo Ehrman. And he talked about that soul stage being under or within the archetype of the famous tale of the Iliad and the Odyssey. And in the Odyssey, Ulysses, the great sacker of cities, leaves to join the Trojan War, the war against the Trojans. And when he leaves, his son Telemachus has just been born. But he's gone, if you remember the story a little bit, he's gone for 20 years. And he then shared that everything that Ulysses outwardly experienced were really experiences of his own soul life, although they're written in an imaginative way from Homer. So here's this great journey from 21 to 42. And then you find that like all of us, you know, that have lived up till 42 or beyond, that we've gone on this journey, and then we start to find our way back to ourselves at 42. And then we have 42 to 49 with Mars ruling, and then 49 to 56 Jupiter, and then in turn the last cycle Saturn from 56 to 63. And after that, it's a grace period. In a sense, the karma that was needed to, in a sense, be extracted out of us or fulfilled is somewhat to a degree behind us. It doesn't mean that we really don't want to move forward and still do things, because there may be things that are incomplete. And so for myself, personally, in my own personal biography, I feel like I'm really at this beginning with Anthroposophy, believe it or not, even though I've been a student of Anthroposophy since I'm about 21 years old. So that gives us the scaffolding outline. And then in turn, we could take that scaffolding, those seven-year cycles, and you could really look into the seven-year cycles of Rudolf Steiner. So,
yeah, I mean,
Viviana, was there anything that
yeah,
you wanted to share from what I just shared there?
It's interesting to hear the planetary signatures, but a lot of people might really not have a relationship to what kind of qualities that really brings to their life. And I think it would be helpful to go through each one of those 7-year cycles and kind of create more of an imaginative picture of what that looks like. And I'd like to read another quote by Rudolf Steiner that really says so much to me about this process that we're embarking on tonight in exploration. And that is, "With our birth into earthly life, the spiritual world asks us a question. It asks, what will we make of our lives as incarnate human beings? We give the answer through our death. To settle with our past, we need knowledge. To form our future, we must have courage. To experience the present, we must grow in devotion. Our thinking needs riddles in order to awaken. Our feeling needs grief in order to mature. Our willing needs hindrances in order to grow strong. Our I must become active. The creative in us must produce new members in our being. Each human being has in life to work and build a spiritual house in which we will be able to live after death. Christ holds in his embrace past, present, and future. He is the helper in all times. From Rudolf Steiner, The Human Being in the Passage of Time. And so, I mean, just kind of to create a context of what we're entering into, I love this imagination of the house that we're working on and building a spiritual house in which we will be able to live after death, he says. And so in life, everything that we undergo through this moon sphere, the Mercury sphere that Elia was alluding to, through these different seven-year cycles, is like a different room in the house to me. And so we can enter into each room and bring more consciousness to it. And for me, this life chart or life map is like having a blueprint to work from, and what can emerge out of that is more of an imaginative and inspirational and an intuitive cognition that really, I mean, it really can be the lodestar for our lives, I believe, and something that can give us a lot of guidance as far as seeing, using it as a compass to see if we're on track and what lessons start to reappear in each seven-year cycle and how they have been transformed, how they've been metamorphosized. Eli, help me out. You're the butterfly man there.
Metamorphosed?
metamorphosed. Okay. Yeah. So, and we can look at that on this chart when we start to live with that. And so, Eli, would you like to start and just give kind of a signature, like a more of an imaginative, like a signature of that moon cycle and what the qualities are? And maybe, you know, since all of us recapitulate the whole evolution of humanity in our lifetime, in our own biographies, both past, and we're laying seeds for the future, it would be great if we could maybe also gain the broader context of, okay, so we have this first seven-year cycle, this moon cycle related to the angels. What in history can we look back to and realize that humanity also had that as a earlier stage of consciousness? Maybe you could go into some of that characteristic, Elia.
I mean, well, you can look at it a couple different ways. If you just looked at the that first seven-year cycle, and it's in the life chart, one way is looking at it in the life chart, which is the age of imitation. And I love the keynote word reverence, because when I've done biography work, when I do biography work, I really like to ask the question, well, what was the home life like for you? What did your dad do? What did your mother do? You know, and what are your remembrances of some of the incidents or conversations? But if reverence is there in the home amongst the parents, imagine it's parents that are anthroposophists and they're following the soul cycle of the year. That's going to create a tremendous element of reverence within that environment. And if we want to look at the cultural ages in the past, and this is what the whole core element of the curriculum for the Waldorf School is, that if we go back, we can go back and we can actually run it parallel to a degree with Rudolf Steiner's own, some of what has come forward is in regards to his own previous incarnations. So we can look back and we can say, well, the Egyptian cultural age, 2909 BC to 747 BC, they're really unfolding. What's unfolding there culturally is the sentient soul, the feeling soul. And we experience that in our life from 21 to 28. But if we take this backward view, then we go into the Persian cultural epoch, and we find now, you know, here's this whole element of the astral body and the whole Zarathustrian culture. And then we can go back to ancient India, and we say here is the buildup of the etheric body. But what's amazing about Rudolf Steiner's own life is that he shares with us his experiences, you know, in the lectures on world history, of one of his earliest incarnations is right at that time period of approximately 3000 BC. So his sentient soul, in a sense, he and Gilgamesh were the founders of that whole cultural age. So when he himself comes into his own 21 to 28 year cycle, or even previous, you can see this previously when he's, you know, in that cycle 14 to 21, that already, you know, he wants to read Kant when he's 13 or 14. So already there's something that matures in him. So again, you know, Vivi, I don't know if I'm just, you know,
well, it would be helpful,
heading
I
in
think,
that right direction. There's so many places you can go with that.
Maybe we could stick with just that first seven-year cycle for a couple of minutes, because you're kind of hopping around there, and I can. I think it's great what you shared, but do you have? You said that the Indian period was with the development of the etheric body. So would the would the first 7 years of the development of the physical body, would that be like Atlantis or Lemuria? Or
that's Atlantis.
Atlantis.
Right, that would be Atlantis. You can move it forward there because the seven race bodies come into being in Atlantis.
Uh-huh.
And if we just, if we talk about those time periods, we're talking seven time periods, individual time periods, that each one is roughly 2,160 years long. So the whole of Atlantis was 2,160 years times seven.
Mm-hmm.
So the whole development process of Atlantis was to bring it to being the physical body.
Mm-hmm.
And here the child, in our own personal life, 1 to 7, is when the moon rules.
Mm-hmm.
And then Mercury, the second cycle. So you can see in the way in the background, you have that 7 to 14 cycle ruled by Mercury. But in the far past, of course, it's all of us in ancient India building up our etheric body, where the life forces are.
Yeah, and you mentioned, you know, reverence. And I know Rudolf Steiner mentions that as a soul faculty, as in the very beginning of knowledge of higher worlds and its attainment. And, you know, it's an ideal, I think, to have reverence. It seems like most children do. I mean, they will imitate it, but I'm guessing there's fewer and fewer environments that actually cultivate that, which is sad. But, you know, maybe there is a counter impulse with those families that are more Waldorf educated, but I think no matter what it's going on in our environment in those first 7 years, it really, whatever it is in our environment, it goes in and has its impression in our physical bodies. We carry that as a signature that we can't help it because we're imitating. So it's great if we do have beauty, if we do have reverence, if we do have a wonder, if we did have a wonder in our own 7-year cycle. And Rudolf Steiner in his autobiography talked about the Alps and the beauty of the Alps and how fortunate he was as a young child to be immersed in nature and this nature experience and the wonder and the beauty of it. And so many children just have this love for nature, and Rudolf Steiner, I think, was no exception to that. And so he said that in Knowledge of Higher Worlds, too, when he's talking about reverence, that that those who were blessed to grow up in a beautiful physical environment really will carry healthful forces throughout their life. And so we can all, you know, take a look at our own first 7 years and reflect on that and begin to kind of take a note of what's there, and not that anything is good or bad, because it all serves us in the long run. We're all here to learn lessons, and it all contributes to us one way or the other. So I guess that's what I'd like to contribute about that that first 7 years. Do you have anything more to say about that, Elia?
No, I think that's good. I think that's good. You can always say more, but I think if we move into that Mercury cycle or even the Venus cycle, if you look at that first 21 years, that's the whole buildup of the physical body. Then come the next 7 year cycles, and you're building up the soul, the threefold soul. In the last three, you're building up the threefold spirit. And what we're seeing today, and I want to address that, is that if you were lucky enough, if you are lucky enough, that you can create that kind of anthroposophical environment, so to speak, that you're giving the child coming in a great gift. Of course, they choose us out of the moon sphere to come and incarnate into our particular environment. But as the centuries go on, we're going to find that we will stand out. And I don't mean this in a prideful way, but spiritually, that we will stand out like a light in a dark world. Because more and more, who takes their children out, you know, into nature? Who brings the caterpillars into the house? Is you don't have to say a word intellectually about reincarnation and karma. If you give a child the experience of caterpillar to chrysalis and then emerging butterfly. Because if you do that with a 6, 7, or 8-year-old, you watch their jaw drop when the butterfly comes out. And their whole physical expression is of awe, which is really important.
Yeah, so, I mean, the thing that really stands out for me with that transition going from the first 7 years to the second, you already mentioned the emergence of the second teeth, the cutting of the second teeth, which is a part of the incarnation process of the child. And in Rudolf Steiner's biography, it's really, you know, with the etheric body, it's the life body, it's that which lifts us up from the earth that we have in relationship to the plant kingdom. And it's also how, when we begin to really have thinking, our thinking faculties begin to take a much more developed form, where we begin to experience ourselves in our thoughts. And in Rudolf Steiner's life, a couple of things stand out for me is that experience that he had of his deceased aunt who had died, who he was able to connect with spiritually before his parents even knew that she had crossed. And so already he has a riddle, and he, you know, in his soul about his capacities, already his perceptive capacities and his questioning about life was leading him into the mysteries of the supersensible. His thinking had been so developed previously in such a way, he had developed enough reverence and enough of the discipline in thinking that he was actually born with a propensity for this spiritual cognition without really having to self-consciously take it up in hand this lifetime, but he did self-consciously take up the mystery of the difference he saw between his own perception and the perception, say, of his parents or those around him. And he said again in his biography that he found out very quickly that other people didn't see the same things that he did. And so that, you know, that led him on a quest because he really wanted to build this bridge. So already there's this signature in his biography to build a bridge between his gift of perception and the perception that he knew that others were carrying, because he also had that perception, but his was a little bit broader of a context.
Yeah, that's very good. I mean, you can see if you just did a biography of Rudolf Steiner, you only get, in a certain way, a superficial, like an image on the surface of a lake. But if you get into, you start to coax out the previous incarnations, it's incredible. The picture then that is behind, let's say, these, like you're alluding to or sharing, the clairvoyant experience he has of his deceased aunt. And you can start to see it in the background of each one of his own seven-year cycles. So what we're seeing there is a prepared life that's archetype for us in the present to understand what biography work is. And it,
oh, Elia, we lost him. Or, uh-oh. Can anybody hear me?
Yes, I can.
Can you hear Elia?
I was until he went away.
Okay, hold on a minute.
Hey, okay.
Something happened. He just, Elia? We're not hearing you. I think you better get on line one.
What happened?
I don't know. You just went blank.
Well, it's gone. I can see it.
No, I... Carol, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Can you hear... Have you been hearing Elia?
The same as for you and BB. I heard him until just a minute ago, but not now.
Okay, I'm on the other line. Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Okay, where did I stop?
Well, in my notes, I have about prepared life.
Yes, you said Rudolf Steiner had a prepared life.
Okay, yeah, I was saying, yeah, he had a prepared life, and I'm saying, and then I went on to say, I think I went on to say, that if we then in turn looked into his previous incarnations, that we can see the developmental process that he went through, let's say, in the Egyptian cultural epic. And he did share with us that he was the reincarnated Iabani with Gilgamesh, who he shared was Ida Begman, well, that's a whole 2,160-year cycle. And in my own personal research, there are two other incarnations within that time period that gave incredible development to his soul life. And then, of course, the
hold on just a second there, Elijah.
Okay.
So I just want to say what you're doing here, what I'm seeing that you're doing here is what he's saying is that each of us recapitulate this past, that each of us has a past in these different soul cycles of the past, and in that Egyptian period from 7 to 14, he's saying that from his research that Rudolf Steiner revealed one, but he's also uncovered a couple of others that then begins to emerge in Rudolf Steiner's life. And Elijah, you could also say, right, that the Egyptian time period is recapitulating itself now in general in humanity, now with the pictures from Hollywood and the entombment of the pictures with film and with...
There's seven cultural ages after the end of Atlantis. The first was the ancient Indian, second the Persian, and the third is the Egyptian cultural age, and the third repeats itself in the fifth. After Egypt was the fourth, the Greco-Roman age, or the birth of the intellectual soul. But starting in 1413, it's the birth of the consciousness soul. And so the third repeats itself in the fifth, meaning all the work that was done in Egypt in Rudolf Steiner and Ida Begman's life is being repeated on a higher level.
Okay, and I would just like to bring it back to this this lifetime. I mean, we know the Egyptians were masterful at building pyramids and at constructing things that had geometrical proportions that are really even hard to replicate today. And during that time, I mean, Rudolf Steiner was, his favorite subject was geometry, which he recognized right away as a language that could begin to build the bridge between the thinking of the physical world and the thinking of the etheric world, which he saw surrounded in nature, surrounding the plants, the animals, and the different geometrical forms of nature. So here's again this mirroring going on and this development of thinking at 7, from 7 to 14 in a rudimentary way that builds the foundation for the rest of life. But this, he's bringing, what you're saying, Eli, is that he's bringing all this past experience with him. And I'd like to point also to what you said about the consciousness soul in the 14th century. It really isn't until the 14th century that we have freedom to begin to think our own thoughts. I mean, up until then, we were not so free because we still had this connection to the spiritual world, and we were still somewhat dependent on the spiritual world, which we still are, but we don't know it anymore. You know, it's like now we can come back to it in a fully conscious way. And so this is what Rudolf Steiner is bringing in this incarnation, is a real consciousness of the spiritual world in thinking and reopening the possibility for humanity to have that experience in this lifetime, that even as in this, it's a necessity for us to be able to get through the current events that we're facing right now.
Well, bear in mind that
threefold soul stage, 21 sentient soul, 21 to 28 sentient soul, 20 to 35 intellectual soul. That's where the real work, the most mature that we see to a degree in the Greco-Roman period was with Aristotle. And then we come to the 35 to 42, and now we have the consciousness soul. So again, the background, if we looked at what Rudolf Steiner was able to accomplish or experience from 21 to 28, look at 18, 19, 20, he's asked by Carl Julius Schroer to edit Goethe's scientific works. So in one sense, he's always a soul stage ahead of almost everyone else because of the ability and the guidance by Michael to mature his forces. So when you come to 35 to 42 in his life, consciousness soul stage for us, it's like he even shares himself when he's 35. It's like something shifted in him where he always had a hard time. Like he'd look at a paragraph, and we read it in no problem, right? Rudolf Steiner often had to look at a paragraph and read it four or five times for the percept of the letters to connect with the concepts of the content and impress itself on his thought life. It was not easy for him. Then he says around 35, something occurred, and it's like this inner and outer became one for him. Incredible for him. But it isn't until he's 40, until he's near, you know, the soul stage of the spirit self, 42 to 49, that he steps forward onto the plane of history and starts speaking publicly. And there he starts to share, yes, he's been clairvoyant since he was 8 years old. And so he lives from that point on, he lives in the realm of the spirit self. Meaning when he would go to sleep at night, it was probably 3 to 4 hours a night. And it was literally not going to sleep. He laid his body into the bed. And in turn, he woke up in his spirit self. And so for four hours an evening, plus the meditative life that went on during the day, he's in and amongst hierarchical beings. He's communicating with angels, archangels, and archai. He would always pose questions to Michael or Sophia and Sophia. So, anything you want to share about that, dear? We didn't cover yet much with the Jupiter or Saturn.
And we didn't. We skipped over the Venus cycle too.
Well, we mentioned a little bit. We could go back to her, look at it. I mean, would you like to share about the Venus cycle?
Well, I just really find it interesting that Rudolf Steiner had such a communication and connection with the people around him at such a young age. He was tutoring already when he was in high school in his Venus cycle, helping the other young people who had learning difficulties with exercises to help them remember and do the mathematics and do the geometry. And so he was already being a teacher and pupil while he was learning. And so this building up of the relationships during that cycle is really, I mean, that's what his focus was. And on the relationships of his contemporaries, like you said earlier about reading Kant, So he was very interested in all of the philosophies of the day because, again, he carries this signature, this soul signature, this mission, this intention for this lifetime to create a new opening out of freedom for the human being to reconnect with the spiritual world through thinking. And so he's a transformed thinking, a heartfelt thinking, an imaginative thinking. So he's already showing those characteristics in his Venus cycle, and I think we can all look back at those impulses in our biographies, and if we had more time, I mean, there's so many different incision points between the nine-year-old change. There's a nine-year-old change, which Eli and I call the break in belonging, and then there's a 12-year Jupiter cycle, and we can look at the 12-year-old change of the Jesus child, the story in the Gospels of the change that came over. And so there's so many rich things, but just to give an impulse, just to give an insight that impulse was within him to reach out to humanity and to help those around him that were in need, and he was doing that already in his Venus cycle, which is the signature of that cycle.
Well, the other to add to that, the other great signature that showed up is his first moon node.
Right.
And if we look at his birth year, 1861, then we look at the year 1869, and we know that later he shared with us that starting in 1840, Michael went to battle with the Ariamonic beings within the spiritual world. And in November of 1879, Michael cast the Ariamonic host down into the earth, into the subconscious of the human being. And in Rudolf Steiner's notebook, at his first moon node, he wrote in, "Ariamon smashed." I don't like the word smashed, but it's more like I like the word penetrated, because what he did then, he shared this in his autobiography, that he conceived the outline of his future book, The Philosophy of Spiritual Activity, meaning that in his own inner thought life, he found his way to freedom. And in that's where he transcended this hold that Ariamon would have on the majority of human beings. And I think that's really significant, what occurred there for him.
And just for those listening who might be listening later who don't have a connection with Ariamon or what Ariamon is, you might want to relate that. Maybe you already did to the spirits of darkness, the Michael casting the dragon down. Are you...
Yeah, well, if we just imagine that we amongst human beings, if we're in a grade, let's say we're in our senior year, and our teacher says to us, "You did really good, but there's certain things in here that I want you to go to summer school for, and so you can't go on immediately with the class." And so if you look at angels, you would have fallen angels. Then if you look at archangels, you would have fallen archangels. And if you had archive beings, you would have fallen archive beings. So the Ariamonic beings are fallen beings from the past. And the way they can get back to their former positions, it sounds funny, but they tempt humanity. And so you have on one side the Ariamonic beings, the fallen Ariamonic hosts, and you have the Luciferic beings as fallen beings also.
So you're talking about the Ariamonic beings as fallen archive beings?
No, they're really, I really think of them more as fallen archangels.
Okay.
Yeah. And there's a third hierarchy of evil, but they're often not talked about. But the one thing they work on is it just think into the idea of the complete annihilation of your I-being. It's like snuffing out a candle flame. So they steal bits and pieces of our I-being. And they're extremely dangerous to our being. And imagine when you produce nuclear fusion, you open up a doorway into their world. And when you drop a bomb, a nuclear bomb, they are in our physical world. So it's a very strong picture, but nonetheless, we are dealing with them in a nuclear world, and many of us in the 50s, 60s, and 70s lived with the idea of a nuclear holocaust, where all of humanity, for a time being, could have been annihilated. But back to our picture again of.
So I just want to say, okay, so they get back to these tempters of humanity are here on their own mission, and really it is up to us to redeem them, even though they are much more experience as far as consciousness goes. We have the capacity for love and empathy, and that's really what they're longing for, I'm guessing, to bring that light of the love, the wisdom of love, to, which is what said at age 18 when you said that he wrote in his notebook, Ahriman smashed, right?
Right, right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, or like I like to use the word overcome.
Yeah.
I mean, smash is a strange word. It's like, you know, you take a hammer, and if it was a vase, you smash it, it's in broken pieces. But it's like in the mystery dramas, there's Ahriman and Lucifer portrayed, and they don't appear to me smashed. But individually, for Rudolf Steiner, yes, I think the experience is much more true to give it a different expression.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so then we could move from there. I mean, he's already having this encounter then with an awareness of evil and an awareness of that at age 18 and how it's overcome. And you said that he wrote the outline then for the book that he would publish later called The Philosophy of Freedom, and he worked on that throughout all of his 20s in different capacities from different experience. He had a very rich experience in his 20s, so maybe we could move on to that and just explore that.
Well, again, biographically with Rudolf Steiner, if he's born in 1861, he has the outline for Philosophy of Freedom, you know, at his first moon node when he's 18, and it coincides with the year 1879. And in 1894, he publishes that book. He's 33 years old.
Mm.
Yeah, he's 33 years old.
Yeah, that's a good point. And what I think is the pivotal point for me in that book, The Philosophy of Freedom, is really how our thinking becomes this capacity of moral imagination. We can transform our thinking if we follow his line of thought by thought. First, we wake up to ourselves as a spiritual being, as the creator of our own thoughts, and in sacrificing ourselves, which we know happened in Christ Jesus' 33rd year, in the sacrificing of ourselves to really listen to another, whether it's a bird, whether it's our garden, whether it's another human being, whether it's the angelic realm, it doesn't really matter. It's this capacity for active listening that he's talking about, where we're really spiritually awake, but that the activity of the thinking has moved from our heads into our hearts, and that from that place we have freedom. From that place we can choose, even though things may look, you know, desperate outwardly, or we have, you know, a very tragic situation to deal with, we can, what he says is we can actually change something in ourself to change the outer circumstances. And that's how this, that's how he chose to meet the world around him all the time. I mean, we see that just incredibly repeated over and over again in the way that he was able to meet the philosophies of the time and had interchanges with all the major thinkers of the time during those years in his 20s. He was constantly thinking, how can I, you know, how can I be the answer to what they're seeking, and how can I take responsibility for that? So he was always being self-conscious in that way, I think.
Yeah, he was developing this tremendous capacity to live into the other, to silence his own reactive thought, and to be able to live into the other. So I'm wondering a little bit how this is landing with our fellow listeners.
This is Carol.
So everybody's line is unmuted. Just feel free to speak up if you have any comments or questions. Or
I am taking this all in like a spot, really ringing.
Can you say that again?
Okay, I'm taking off speaker. I'm just saying, this is Carol. I'm taking this all in like a sponge because it's bringing lots of little pieces together. And so I'm really appreciating it very much. And I just, the very last thing you said, I just thought, oh, it reminded me of something that happened just about an hour ago. And when you said that he was developing the capacity to live into the other, and this would silence his own reactive thoughts. That was really powerful, because I just got an email from a friend, and I just was very reactive. You know, she's a very close friend on this anthroposophical journey together, and she said something that just seemed so out of touch and naive that I just ended up thinking, oh my gosh. And so it just seems like I can see right there this capacity to live into the other and silence some of that reactivity is a project I still have a long ways to go on.
Thanks, girl. I feel the same way. It happens to me a lot.
Yeah.
I'm getting a little bit better. I mean, especially just out of my own biography, I find, like, I just come back from a coin convention in Chattanooga, and I go out two or three weekends a month, and there might be like 125 coin dealers with tables inside of a bourse. And when somebody, you know, I make an invitation or an offering to the person behind the table, if they accept the offer, I sit down, and then they look at, I show them my merchandise. It's like an album full of coins. And it's like I have to be very sensitive to them and what they like, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And I find more and more of that, to a degree, you know, if I hold myself back, it just makes a difference. And I want them to be comfortable, too. So, you know, there's interactive thoughts. It's not like you can do philosophy with them because you are there to buy and sell rare coins. But I find, you know, the listening element can really help because it gives them a space out of freedom to really to buy something.
Yeah.
And so it's just a sharing personally how you can take anthroposophical thoughts and really bring them into almost everything you're doing in outer life or inner life.
Yeah. So just by your being silent, even though inside you might prefer, you would say something to kind of maybe what bring your opinion into it, which might be different than theirs. In your being silent, it opens the space for what to happen.
Yeah, well, exactly. Like, I don't touch religion. I don't touch politics. You know, I'm a northerner in the land of the South.
Yeah.
And they really hold the world differently than me. They don't know how I hold the world. They get me through being a professional numismatist. They get that right away because when they open my book, I can tell by the look, when they look down at the page, there's 20 coins on a page and there might be, you know, 15 pages. So as they're going through them, by the time they get to the second page, almost automatically they always say, oh, you really have nice coins.
Okay.
Okay, well, that's great. I think we should maybe get back to the biography unfold, or more comments, please, if anybody else wants to share.
Hi, guys. I wanted to just kind of make sure I'm catching on a little here. Trying to do active listening. with these stages as these periods related, say, the Indian and the Persian and so on, those stages as related to Steiner, then am I to understand, or is this not correct, that then as we go through 1 to 7, 7 to 14, and so on, then is it like unto our experience? Is that in relationship to what Steiner experienced, or was that unique specifically to Steiner?
Vlad, do you want to answer that?
To a degree, Bibi.
Can you, Eli, can you reflect back the question? I was going to do that, but I think it might be helpful. It might.
Well, I think she was saying that in relationship to these cultural epics that we shared that Steiner had gone through, or that are the archetypal background of the life chart, do we also experience that in our own personal 1 to 7, 7 to 14, 14 to 21? Is that what you were asking about,
yes.
Bibi?
Yes, that is correct. Uh-huh.
Okay. So, because Rudolf Steiner is already at such a matured, advanced stage in this life, we recapitulate something similar, but not to the depth nor to the degree that he did. But with him sharing out of what his own experiences were and then what's in the karmic relationships, we're able to draw forth this life chart. Then within the life chart, a biographer doing biography work, and I just say this personally, you develop your own kind of what I would call an historical cognitive principle or something within you that helps
you read between the lines or in the background of the person sharing their story. So if I do biography work with someone, I really start out with a legal pad that's empty. And I ask them, I really want to coax out, let's say, over four sessions with them, their whole life story. I want them to tell me their life story, and I coax them with certain prompts that they can answer. You know, like, you know, where were you born? What city? What country? You know, were your parents married? You know, what was your environment like? You know, what's your first memory? That's really important. And so you're placing the story into these seven-year cycles. You can only go back into these great archetypal epics with Rudolf Steiner's life because he shared enough about it in world history in the light of anthroposophy, which were the lecture cycles in the evening of the Christmas conference, and elsewhere, the mystery dramas, and the lectures he gave on occult history. He's trying to tell us that out of that sharing from these different incarnations, one can stand back and you will get a layered picture of who the individuality of this individual that we call in the 20th century Rudolf Steiner. But in the 12th century, Rudolf Steiner is Thomas Aquinas. And in Greece, he's Aristotle. And way back in the beginning of the Egyptian cultural age, he's one of the leading characters in the oldest recorded document we possess, which is the story, the saga or the epic of Gilgamesh and Iabani. So the whole leitmotif is in that particular story, where those two individualities develop a friendship. And Iabani is clairvoyant, and he lives in the wild. He's not a, what would you say, a cultured individual. Well, Gilgamesh is already an advanced soul, and he's a conqueror. And the two of them go up against they form a friendship.
Mm-hmm.
And you could really read in the background, and I can translate it and say that Michael, the Archangel Michael, sent Iabani down into incarnation to establish a friendship with Gilgamesh. Mm-hmm. Now, Iabani and Gilgamesh enter into the city once they conquer it, and there was a temple holding a particular secret of the Ishtar mysteries. And in the legend, Iabani goes into that temple, and you have to take this, what I say here, properly. But the mysteries of that temple had a lot to do with sexuality or life force or the temple priestess. Because the name, the priestess of the temple itself, we know historically, is Ishtar. So she's a goddess. So there's a mystery that they possessed, and they were able to affect Iabani in such a way that it probably drew him deeper into his body and to be, in a certain sense, less clairvoyant and more human. And you can see him repeating this in his own biography. And then there's a breakdown between the two of them as a conqueror and the priests of the priestesses of the Ishtar Mysteries called down the Bull of Heaven. You know, it's a symbol of Taurus. And Gilgamesh is able to overcome the Bull of Heaven. And out of anger, they cause a sickness into the city, and they cause the death of Iabani. Mm-hmm. But here's the real interesting thing, is that Iabani now, in the spiritual world...
Elias?
Yes?
Who's they?
Who's they?
You said they caused a
sickness. Yeah, I said the priestesses.
Okay.
And then I said, yeah, that they had sent down the Bull of Heaven. And that they, mean the priestesses of the Ishtar Mysteries, caused the death of Iabani. But now he's in the spiritual world, and Rick Steiner goes to great pains to share with us that the connection between Iabani and Gilgamesh was enhanced, and that Iabani inspired Gilgamesh to go outwardly look for
the Fountain of Youth.
The Fountain of Youth. And he actually journeys from, think of this, Ur in Chaldea, all the way to a place in Europe where there was a colony of the Hibernian Mysteries.
Oh.
And there he's attempted to be kept awake for 7 days and seven nights through the use of planetary metals. Well, that right there is the whole foundation of Ida Begman, because that's what Gilgamesh is, for anthroposophical medicine. It's all in the planetary metals. And So imagine he's sharing this story with 800 people, and Ida Begman is in the audience, and so is Murray Steiner. But he had already said that he'd talked about all of this in 1910, but there was resistance in the room via Murray Steiner, and he stopped speaking about these things.
Mm.
But he's wanting the members to realize that she is going to assume a very strong leadership position within the Anthroposophical Society. So, again, going back to our personal lives, we should be able to feel that we can embed ourselves into the historical evolution that he's giving us in world history in the light of anthroposophy, meaning we're in that story. And here we are in the present, we're developing something that was given out, let's say, 7 years ago, and here we are on the phone with a teleconference able to share out insights into biographical work, biographical studies. And the reason why we choose Rudolf Steiner is because he's such an archetype, what he shared. And it's incredibly meaningful if we just did a whole series of calls that were on his own biography. And I'm talking a 5,000-year biography from 3,000 BC to the present. Then we'd get the stature of this individuality alongside of Ida Begman. We should never separate her from him.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, again, back to, you know, your question about our own personal life, there's where there's so much that can get coaxed out when, you know, you hear the story of the individual from 1 to 7 all the way to 63, and you place it into a life chart, but you're also there intuitively having insights, literally from their angel and your angel, what you can share with them, that they can have an insight, a breakthrough about their own life.
Wow. Very, very interesting.
Was that helpful, BB?
Yes, it truly was. I think I glimpsed a little bit anyway, thanks to you. this is just fascinating, fascinating material.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, I'd just like to say Rudolf Steiner and Eliah's birthday are very close together. Eliah was born on the 28th of February, and he has the sun in Pisces, at least in the tropical chart, as did Rudolf Steiner, and they both share this historical capacity of looking into karma with Saturn opposite the sun. And so there's this historical view that Rudolf Steiner had a gift for, and Eliah also shares that, plus with the Piscean or Aquarian, depending on which way you're looking at it, there is this, from a Piscean perspective, this intuitive grasp and this imaginative cognition that's there. And then from an Aquarian perspective, which is more the sidereal zodiac, this capacity for the new emerging thinking capacities with the etheric Christ. So I just want to say that because it's rare to find somebody like Eliah who has so many different threads that he can weave together, and both from his own research and from Rudolf Steiner. So thanks, Eliah, for sharing that.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Well, that's fascinating, too, and may I say happy belated birthday.
Thanks, Phoebe.
That's fascinating, the similarities or how best I say of Eliah to Steiner, and I think that in and of itself is very interesting.
Yeah, so it's like 10 or about a quarter to 9 right now. Should we do our best just to do some broad strokes through the rest of the U-chart, Eliah, and relate it to Rudolf Steiner? Maybe we should stick to this lifetime, this past lifetime, and just because it's so rich. I mean, from 40 years old on, it's so rich. I know you know this story inside and out, so maybe you could make an attempt. And I guess if you want to bring in these threads from the past, you know, if your intuition is leading you in that direction, you know, if you can weave it in the short time we have left.
Well, because we have a short time left, and I would really like to save what you just asked about there for our next call, I think it would really be important to kind of think into it as if the call is being listened to by people that aren't on the call, but are also asking the question about, what is biography work, or can I do biography work, or would you do biography work with me?
Okay. All right.
Yeah.
Yeah, so what I'm hearing you say is you'd like to take a pause from the biography for now of Rudolf Steiner and these unfolding soul cycles and pick it up in our next call next month?
Yes.
Is that what you're saying, in April?
Yeah.
Okay.
I still want to talk with Carol and Bibi also, but I think what, you know, I would like to do that after we kind of finish what I would call the recording of the call.
Okay. Oh. Okay.
Yeah.
Well. Yeah. So Eliah and I, and especially Eliah, I do a different kind of biography work. He works mostly with looking karmically at the biography and giving intuitions and really it's bringing people together with a real focus and with a real intention. And I think, you know, so many times, like, I know that we have a life intention for our lives. Each of us has a life intention for our lives. We were here before we came into incarnation, if we believe what we know to be true from our inner sense of truth and from what Rudolf Steiner says. And if, as it says in the Bible, that if there is no vision, the people perish. And I think it's so important to really find our destiny and initiative and really begin to have an intuition that we are fulfilling what we came here to do. And I just like to, Eliah, do you have that quote from Karmic Relationships about that destiny? And oh, here, I have it here. I just like to read this because I think it's important, and I think some of you have heard this before, but it bears repeating again because it's something that he says we can just paste on our souls in golden letters, to be a person of initiative and beware lest through hindrances of your own body or hindrances that otherwise come in your way, you do not find the center of your being, where is the source of your initiative. Observe that in your life, all joy and sorrow, all happiness and pain will depend on finding or not finding of your own individual initiative. So, and then he goes on to say, this should stand as though in golden letters constantly before the souls who seek to serve in collaboration with the wise guiding powers of destiny. Initiative lies in karma, and much of what meets us in our lives will depend on the extent to which we can become willingly, actively conscious of it. And for me, that really sums up the work of biography work, is really bringing an imaginative cognition to our biographies in such a way that we can begin to cultivate a sense for what is wanting to emerge in our lives and in our lessons and in our soul stages, so that we can really be on target with what we came here to do and what we came here to learn and what our lessons are and how we orient to it. And so Eliah and I decided we wanted to, in light of this conversation and in light of we've both been doing biography works of different kind for many years, and his aim, his expertise is really, he's got this Piscean karmic perspective that he brings when he hears somebody's story and can begin, and first, I mean, when there is this intuition, and I want to back up for a minute and say we'd like to offer this as a gift, as something that would be a gift, as a sampling of what could be possible, and in that it would be our gesture to you, for you, if you have a longing, if you have a question, if you're wanting support for more clarity in your own life and with your own initiatives and what's being called for in your biography, either Eliah or I or both of us at the same time, whichever you feel a resonance for or a need for, we'd love to do tandem ones, but some people feel more comfortable with he or I. We'd like to just offer a free session as a gift to those listening who are either here live on the call or to those who are listening in later, to be able to listen to what your questions are and to hear what your needs are and your longings and to your biggest challenge in your life. What is your, whether it's health, whether it's relationships, whether it's money, whether it's purpose, whatever it is, and then give you some, whatever our intuitive take is on it. From a little bit of biography work, we won't be able to go into much depth in one session, but we'd like to give you a taste of it. And then at the end of that session, there would be options to go into more of an immersed program and interchange if it felt comfortable, and if not, that's fine too, and we can have gotten to know each other better and we'll have gained an insight into those who may be listening, and we'd just like to offer that as a possibility. So, Eliah, is that what you were?
Yeah. Yes. Now, if we're ready to close, I don't mean close sharing with our callers right now, but more like the recorded part of it. I'd like to share a closing verse.
Oh. Okay. All right.
Yeah.
Oh, well, I would just like to mention before we do that, that it's a lunar eclipse. No, it's a solar eclipse. It's a new moon tomorrow, and it's a solar eclipse at the same time. And we talked about a couple of things tonight in this call, and the new moon is always a new time, a good time for new beginnings, and the solar eclipse is a, Steiner describes it as like a release valve for the evil in the world, and we talked about how to meet this evil through love and through imaginative cognition. And I just wanted to bring that to attention because I would love for everyone to kind of take a note. There's two eclipses this month. The first is now on tomorrow, which is the solar eclipse, and then there's a lunar eclipse later in the month. I believe it's March 23rd, but I'm not sure exactly. I looked at it yesterday. So just as your own spiritual research project, if you could, you know, maybe do some inner work and look at your biography in light of the conversation that we've had tonight and see what needs releasing, see what you can bring a new orientation to. I mean, it's a great time. The new moon is always a great time to write a new script, a new story, because so much of our lives are shaped and formed by the stories we tell ourselves about the past that get put the past in the present and the future. And what the beautiful thing about the biography work is using awakening to that I consciousness and being able to really create out of the future, out of a new imagination, out of something that can lead us beyond the limitations of the past and forge a new path to the future. So I just wanted to share that before we actually close. So go ahead, Elia. And I'd like to read another short verse after you finish yours.
Thank you, Viviana.
All right.
The wishes of the soul are springing. The deeds of the will are thriving. The fruits of life are maturing. I feel my destiny. My destiny finds me. I feel my star. My star finds me. I feel my goals in life. My goals in life are finding me. My soul and the great world are one. Life grows more radiant about me. Life grows more arduous for me. Life grows more abundant within me.
And then there's one more that I'd like to share by Rinke Visser. Judging is the voice of the past. Love is the power of the present. Trust is the vessel for the future. In the now, past and future meet. Okay, Simon, I'll turn off the recording.